And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, bringing you the news you don't ordinarily get to hear in the corporate media. Today, we're going to be having a few interviews. We'll be starting out with Eve Engler. Got some important subjects to discuss there. So what we should have right now is we're going to have Eve joining us. Let me see. Eve, do we have you on the line?
I'm here. How's it going, Brandon?
Very good. I'm just going to boost your volume a bit more. For those of you who are just tuning in, Eve Engler, he's an author and an activist, a Canadian author and activist, involved in many causes, and he's published several books, which we've all discussed on this program. They've become some of the key ways to understand our government's policy towards Haiti and our government's policy towards other countries, whether it be Israel or the rest of the world in general. So Eve is the author of Canada and Israel, Building Apartheid. He's the author of The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy. Together with Anthony Fenton, Eve wrote Canada in Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority. And talking about his sports background, he also wrote a book, Playing Left Wing, From Rink Rat to Student Radical. Now, Eve, we have never really discussed that book on our program before, but one of these days we're going to get around to talking about sports, particularly hockey. We're going to bring that up. For people that might not be familiar with the book, The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy, what could you tell us about that book?
Well, basically, it's an overview, a critical overview of Canadian foreign policy, and it really comes out of participating in the Haiti Solidarity Movement back in 2004, 2005, 2006, and being taken aback by the extent to which the Canadian government had participated in this imperial crime in Haiti. And going into learning about Canada's role in Haiti, I sort of had this idea that Canadian foreign policy was different than U.S. foreign policy. And coming out of the Haiti Solidarity Movement, coming out of the worst of the political killing after the coup in the February 2004 coup, I thought that it was important to look at whether Canada had acted a similar way elsewhere aside from Haiti. And the Black Book is really just an overview of a long history of pro-corporate, pro-empire Canadian foreign policy, from support for the coup in Chile in 1973 to the U.S. war in Vietnam to gunboat diplomacy going back to the 1917 on behalf of Canadian banking interests in Costa Rica, to tacit support for apartheid South Africa, and the list goes on.
Yes, and that book, of course, again, is The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy by Eve Engler, E-N-G-L-E-R. You can Google that. It'll be easy to find, and I recommend purchasing that and reading it if you haven't already. Eve has been so important for our understanding of what Canada is doing in the world. And like you've said, the Haiti Solidarity Movement, trying to figure out what was happening in Haiti and what we could do to stop our government from harming Haitian people, led to a lot of research and disclosure on what else Canada has been doing in the world. Unfortunately, Haiti seems to be one of our biggest playgrounds or testing grounds. The Canadian government in playing a junior partner role to what the United States, France, other countries are doing. We've got our own financial empire that includes Haiti. And Haiti's been in the news once again in the last few weeks, in the last 2 months. And whenever it's in the news, it's usually bad news, unfortunately. And it's usually some of the distressing issues we've been covering on earlier programs. And some of those have evolved quite in a frightening manner. So this time around, we have a situation where the former dictator, Baby Doc Duvalier, had returned to Haiti. And then shortly thereafter, after an outcry in Haiti, there had been increased overtures from the former elected president, President Aristide, to return as well. And there's a few issues we can get into on that. I guess the first one is the way we treated Baby Doc Duvalier, or the way the media covered it, once he returned to Haiti, it was a bit of a surprise. And certainly they weren't that friendly to Duvalier. He's a notorious dictator who came in the middle of a crisis in Haiti for no clear reason. But it also seems there was no real attempt to arrest him, put him in jail. I'm not sure about this, but I mean, did anyone have jurisdiction over him? Why is Duvalier still free in Haiti?
Well, I mean, I think he's still free because he represents a certain sector of the Haitian elite. And there was sort of a small effort that he was brought in for questioning by the Haitian police, but as you pointed out, he's not sitting in jail, even though he's known to have been responsible for thousands and thousands, into the tens of thousands of people who were killed in political violence by his thugs during his 15-year reign in office from 1971 to 1986, where, you know, he was put in office at the age of 19 by his father. And I think there's, you know, lots of embezzlement of money that's all pretty well established. There's been a push by human rights lawyers, for instance, at the Bureau Avocat International and the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, which the two work together. One's at Paul Plant's base and one is based in Boston. They've pushed forward for the arrest and they've laid out the case. But it's important to note that Baby Doc, the head of his security team in Haiti when he arrived, was Jodel Chamblain. Jodel Chamblain is a known death squad leader, second in charge of the FRAP death squad during the first coup against Aristide in 1991 to 1994. And Chamblain was also involved in the February 2004 coup against Aristide the second time. He was the, you know, the main power base behind Guy Philippe, who led the paramilitary assault against the Aristide government that provided the pretext for overthrowing Aristide in February 2004. So I guess the, you know, the case against Duvalier is, it's clear that Duvalier is a well-known dictator that has a lot of blood on his hands, has stole lots of money. But there are people in positions of power, both within Haiti and presumably also within, maybe within some sectors of the U.S. government, or at least within maybe the Republican Party in the U.S., I see him as an ally, and that hasn't been a proper pursuit of Baby Doc Duvalier.
Yes, one of our dictators, something we've been learning more about in the news in the Middle East in the last few weeks. We've kept up that practice to a sense. Now, when you say all this, and we're thinking about the death squads that are associated with Duvalier, it just strikes me again how much they've had free reign in Haiti too many times, and they were among the groups that put pressure on the elected government of President Aristide. So he's someone who suffered as a result of the legacy of Duvalier, trying to remove that dictatorial legacy. And it's shocking then to see how the media has treated Aristide's possible return to Haiti. And I guess to take a second look at this, you know, Aristide coming back, he pitched that idea, he mentioned that to the South African government and a number of the responsible international bodies that he would like to return to Haiti since he was removed so undemocratically in the first place. There's a response in Haiti to that already, which is very positive. People have been calling for Aristide's return as a political demand to respect the elections that have occurred in the past, to respect his legacy. So there's already a different reception, obviously, in Haiti between Aristide and Duvalier. So what was the reaction, I guess, in Haiti in general once people learned about the possibility of Aristide returning?
Well, I mean, the reports that I've read are of people who are incredibly poor hearing rumors that Aristide was just returning, and you know, a group of eight people will spend a small amount of money they have to get a taxi to go to the airport to welcome Aristide. So there's, you know, talk about a massive cleanup of Port-au-Prince and the slum neighborhoods as a way to welcome Aristide back. You'll see when Aristide does ultimately return, there will be tens, probably hundreds of thousands of people welcoming him in Port-au-Prince. And, you know, the best way to understand Aristide, what Aristide means to Haitian politics, is he's the symbol of the poor majority in Haiti, so long excluded from political life, being allowed to participate in political life. Aristide is that symbol. It's a symbol of, during his time in office, there was a massive reduction in political violence. There was small attempts to improve the lot of the majority poor. I mean, these are, you know, very, very modest reforms from an outside perspective, but reforms that had consequence. You know, Haiti's a place that has been run by that small elite with their foreign backers so wholeheartedly for so long that the modest reforms that Aristide was pursuing, the building of schools, increasing of the minimum wage, the promotion of the Creole language and the language of the all Haitians versus French language, which is just the language of the elite, you know, the valorization of voodoo and other reforms. So there will be massive There already is massive excitement about Aristide's return, and you see that next to Duvalier. You got one hand, you got a symbol of democracy in the majority poor. On the other hand, you have somebody who is Duvalier, who represents, the worst of the foreign-backed dictatorships in Haitian history.
Well, it seems that you're feeling a lot of this energy that the Haitians were feeling about Aristide's possible return, and certainly there have been a number of interesting reports about that. Now, as you've said, there's two different things happening. On the one hand, excitement about Aristide potentially coming back, and on the other hand, not a lot of warmth or welcoming feelings towards the former dictator Duvalier. And there's that opposition occurring in Haiti, but in the North American press, it's oddly different. So when we read about it in the New York Times or the Globe and Mail in Canada and the United States, we're getting a different reception. And I know I have an example. Yeah, New York Times, there was an article in January saying that Aristide rose to power as a champion of Haiti's poor, but became notorious for his violent crackdowns of political dissent. Now, of course, Joe Emmisberger took that apart on his ZSpace page as to how there's no violent crackdowns under Aristide. There was the opposition towards the death squads invading from the Dominican Republic. So there's already an attempt to sort of slander and put the two together, put Aristide and Duvalier together. And then you have similar reports. The Globe and Mail had an article with similar views, and the United States itself has not been warm to the idea of Aristide returning. It seems that they're one of the key people blocking it, not South Africa, not Haiti, but the United States. And they've said that the U.S. has said Haiti needs to move forward, not think about the past. So are you seeing that there's definitely a different reception in North America than in Haiti, perhaps in an attempt to build equivalence between Duvalier and Aristide?
For sure. I mean, you see that repeatedly. There's like as if there's some equivalence between the first ever elected president in Haitian, democratic elected president in Haitian history, who was then won a second mandate. In both cases, was overthrown by to foreign backed coups to varying degrees of how much the foreigners were responsible. Very responsible in the second case. It was decisive support by the U.S., France, and Canada in overthrowing Aristide in 2004. Versus comparing that to Duvalier, it's madness, right? Duvalier, during the Duvalier dictatorships, the widely accepted 50,000 people were killed by the political violence by the dictatorship. During the 1991 to 1994 coup against Aristide, something in the range of 3,000 to 5,000 people were killed in political violence. During Aristide's second mandate from 2001 to 2004, which his critics claim to have been, full of human rights violations, the best estimate is between 10 and 30 people were killed in political violence, and in one way or another, one could, and this is taking very broad definition, could sort of blame on supporters of Aristide in one way or another. So we're talking about a massive, massive, massive reduction in human rights violations during the time of Aristide in office. It's not perfect. It's a highly impoverished place. It's not, Haiti was, far from easy place to live and during the time of Aristide's time in office, but all indicators suggest political violence went up immediately after he was killed, according to British, or after he was overthrown. The British medical journal, The Lancet, showed there's 8,000 people killed in the 22 months after Aristide was overthrown. 4,000 of those people were killed by political actors of one sort or another. So a massive spike in human rights violations after Aristide was overthrown. The Canadian media, you have, the majority poor in Haiti, and for that matter, even it's almost across the political spectrum in Haiti, because the Haitian Constitution is really clear that Haitians can't be exiled, right? So Aristide, according to the Haitian Constitution, has the right to return, and that the reason the Haitian Constitution has that in it is because there were so many exiles during the Duvalier period, right? So there's a constitution written right after the Duvalier period, and so it was very explicit that anyone that's a Haitian citizen cannot be exiled from the country. So Aristide has the right to return, and even lots of his political enemies in Haiti even admit, they don't even want to come out publicly say he shouldn't be allowed to return, because they know it's so clear in the Haitian Constitution. But you have, you know, media outlets like the Globe and Mail editorial from about a week ago now that said explicitly Aristide should not return. Aristide should not be allowed to return. And this is just the height of, you know, imperial arrogance on behalf of the Globe and Mail editorial writers. You know, they know what's better for Haiti than the majority of Haitians or than the Haitian constitution. And it's a really, you know, just flagrant. And it speaks to the powerlessness and the double standards of a dominant media, right? Haitians are so powerless in this, you know, in the current context that they can get away with this just arrogant attitude in the editorial writers that says that, you know, it's up to them to tell Haitians that, you know, the twice elected presidents are allowed to return to the country.
Yes, to have Duvalier in the country and then say no to Aristide. And it seems that some North American journalists, editorial writers, and so forth really are squandering the opinions of most Haitian people, really trying to put that down and suppress that. And the arrogance you refer to is something you can see demonstrated in a number of other areas, including the way we've handled disease and other things in Haiti. We know, like you said, or as you said, Haiti is far from a perfect place, and right now it's in a great deal of crisis. One of the crises it's facing has been the disease epidemics. The last time we spoke to a member of the Canada Haiti Action Network, I believe it was Jean Saville a couple months ago, and he referred to how United Nations troops, possibly Nepalese troops, were a probable vector in bringing some of those sicknesses to Haiti. But now new information has come out as well, a mechanism by which people in Haiti can get sick. This is the cholera. I think it was a private company. Could you tell us more about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the background, yeah, for sure. Now it's widely confirmed that it was the cholera epidemic in Haiti that has killed more than 4,000 people already, left tens of thousands of people ill, that it's a strain, a cholera strain that came from the Nepalese troops. There was a new deployment of Nepalese troops to the Artibonite Valley. But the backstory to this is even, I think, more kind of galling, which is the fact that it was a private company operating a UN base in the Artibonite that had just underbid another company to get the contract to manage the base. And they were taking the excrement, the sewage produced on the base, and simply dumping it into a river that people were drinking from. And I think it's just reflective of just, you know, they obviously didn't know there was a cholera strain when they're doing this, but it's just reflective of the sort of valuelessness of Haitian life to the UN occupation. You know, if some company can maybe save a couple bucks by disposing of the waste in such a way, you know, it's worth doing. And, you know, the consequences for Haitians is going to be extreme. You know, not already, you know, 4,000 people dead, but also the fact that the public sanitation system in Haiti is so weak that it's very likely this cholera is going to be in the country for years, if not decades to come. And Haiti had not seen cholera in recorded history. So this is not a disease that's been around Haiti. So, you know, people's, you know, the capacities to fight it are not as strong. So I think it's just another reflection of just the valuelessness of Haitian life to the foreign powers that really run Haiti today.
Well, it's strange or shocking to see how conditions have become so medieval in the country when there's so many NGOs, human rights, humanitarian aid, pro-democracy organizations in the country. In fact, Haiti has increasingly become known as a republic of NGOs, in that every single service is being provided by NGOs. I read a newspaper article that said there are maps of Haiti that show sectors of the country occupied by the different NGOs. So it's like, you know, you'd see a map of Haiti and one part of it is one NGO and another part. So that's who seems to be running the country and providing services. So despite all of this heavy, heavy NGO presence, probably the heaviest in the Western Hemisphere, the poverty's not being alleviated. Has there been any change in the way that, you know, funding is distributed or money is distributed? I know that in the past, the aid to the state had never really happened. There had not been a lot of money that the government could disperse to build institutions, build capacity, and so on. So is this still being done hand to mouth in Haiti?
For sure. I mean, that's one of the, you know, just the further confirmations in the aftermath of the earthquake 13 months ago that left a couple hundred thousand people dead was just how ineffective so-called non-governmental organizations are in providing the basic services
that, you know, people need to live and to survive. And there's been a policy, very conscious policy from decision makers, mostly in Washington, but it's been reflected in Ottawa as well, of using non-governmental organizations as a way to undermine the Haitian government, the Haitian state, for their own political reasons. It's got some very specific political reasons in terms of the NGOs played an important role in destabilizing the Aristide government in the lead-up to the 2004 coup, but it has a more longer-term goal, and it's a sort of flip side of neoliberal capitalism, right? On one hand, you could call on the state to downsize, to remove itself from the economy, to privatize company, privatize state-owned companies, to, you know, open up the market to foreign investors. But on the other hand, you push what they've done is they've pushed the NGOs as the institutions to take up the different social services, the schooling, sanitation, healthcare, etc. And in Haiti, before the earthquake, more than 80% of all schools were run by charities, usually or often foreign charities that different groups in Canada or the U.S. financed. And it's led to a completely you know, hollow Haitian government and Haitian state. And that in the context of the earthquake, just the lack of capacity in the Haitian government to respond was really flagrant, and we're just seeing that play out. And you know, it's one of the things that I find so troubling about all this is that lots of people here in Canada who are, you know, sort of progressive minded people who believe that the government should provide public education or, you know, believe in public sanitation systems, they're more than happy. They don't even think twice about funding a Canadian-based organization, Canadian-based NGO that will, you know, go and undermine the Haitian government's ability to provide that same kind of education system. And, you know, the Canadian International Development Agency back in 2005 admitted that its policy of directing money towards NGOs instead of the Haitian government really undermined the state's capacity to provide, you know, play a role in people's lives. And we're seeing that play out, and Haiti is, without a doubt, has the most NGOs anywhere in the world per capita by a large margin. And the model doesn't work. You can't build, development's not going to come through, you know, foreign charities operating, you know, schooling system, sanitation, etc.
I'm inclined to think of one commentator who noticed that there was NGOs with paid staff making three times as much money as the regular salary in Haiti, fully outfitted operations, and 2 miles away there's emaciated, starving kids. And this man, Mr. Klein, Eric Klein, he said, you know, I'm sick and tired of these NGOs coming up with excuses. There's no excuse for this. And certainly what we've learned reflects the things you've said, the things that the materials you've written for Chan, Anthony Fenton, and others altogether have elaborated on the NGO situation. So we appreciate the work you've done. You've paved the way, made it possible for issues about some of the effectiveness problems to come out into the open and be discussed. So, Yves, I'd like to thank you very much for being here. We caught you on your cell phone, and you know, we're pleased that you could bring this to our audience. We should be covering this more often. We learn so much about international structures and organizations when we talk about Haiti. So thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for having me, Brennan.